John L. Crockett, C-R-O-C-K-A-T-T. Well, the war started in September, and in October I went to a radio training school for Merchant Navy radio officers. And in the spring of 1940, after 3 months at this place, I got my qualifications and joined the Blue Funnel Line and went to sea. I was there for 6 years. It's a lot of things. There are so many different things. Some funny things, some terrible things. I was a radio officer, and that was all I ever was for the first 5 years of the war. And according to the chance I described, I became a seamanship instructor for the last year of the war. But basically, I was a radio officer, and it was a pretty boring job, really, because of the war, you observed radio silence. The only time you transmitted is if you were, either had been torpedoed or were about to be torpedoed. So in my case, I was never torpedoed. I didn't transmit very often. Twice in the whole war, I pressed the Morse key and sent a message. And in one case, it was very early in the war when I sent a message at port side saying we were coming into harbour, which was nothing. Because at that time, the Germans weren't there. And the only other time I pressed the key was in the South Atlantic somewhere when we were being chased by a U-boat. I was in a very fast ship then, and we could actually sail faster than the U-boat. But the rule was, if you were being chased, you sent a particular signal. It was SS in Morse, and then giving your position, which meant we were being attacked by a submarine. And this happened, and I was in the radio room, but by one of my colleagues, who was a little older than me, was on duty. And he got the message to send out the SSS message. And he froze, he couldn't do it. And I asked him, I said, what's the trouble? He said, I can't do it. And so I leaned over him and sent the message over his shoulder. And that was the only time I ever transmitted during 5 years of war. Extraordinary. But I suppose the outstanding memory is really of the sea and the occasional convoy battles. When the ships coming home from all over the world bringing food and so on, most of whom came into Liverpool, and we had to be convoyed because the U-boats were hunting us in packs. And coming as we did, I was going mostly to Australia and the Far East until the Japs got to the Far East. And so we came up from the Cape of Good Hope, and they assembled the convoys in Freetown, which is a huge open port on the West African coast, which deep and there's massive space. And when they assembled 50 or 60 ships, they would then, we'd sail with an escort of naval ships. And you went out and then you went north, and as you got further north, the U-boat packs were waiting. And I suppose from about, I don't know, a day's sail south of Gibraltar until you got into home waters, they attacked you every night. And it was rather tiring business because you had to work during the day as well. But that went on for roughly the 2 or 2.5 weeks from when they started to when they sheered off. And it was just sometimes a lot of noise and lots of bangs. And ships, I was lucky, I was in 4 different ships and was never torpedoed. But I saw other ships going down all round. And I suppose a very vivid memory I have is of we were escorted on one occasion by an aircraft carrier, and the fighter, by this time the Germans were attacking us from the air and from the sea, and so fighters took off from the aircraft carrier to fight off the bombers who were coming. And one night in a howling gale, you've probably never flown an airplane, but I have since then, landing on aircraft carriers like trying to land on a postage stamp. And in a gale, it's going like this, moving up and down and sideways. And I saw five planes take off, do their fighting, come back and crash and disappear into the water. One of them burnt on the deck. And that's the sort of thing that you really can't forget, because those people took off knowing that they had a marginal chance of getting back again. And a lot of them didn't. And that's just one extraordinary thing. But there are so many extraordinary things that I could go on. A lot of people think that the Battle of the Atlantic was people going from here across to America. Of course, there were convoys going across to America. But far more of our food and supplies came up the South Atlantic from Australia and New Zealand. We loaded thousands and thousands of tons of lamb and butter in Australia and New Zealand, brought it home. And that was how the country was fed. Mm. Extraordinary. We did a lot of things. I read a lot. I remember one ship I was on, the second mate was a keen chess player, and I was a keen chess player. So we played a game of chess which lasted for about 6 months, because every time one of us won, we went back and decided where the other chap had made a mistake, started from there and played it again. And the same game went on, say, for about 6 months. But I lost him then. And, well, he was lost in the ship later on. I don't think we thought about them as crews. It was just a thing that was there to shoot at us. And we shot back as we could. The merchant ships, as you know, theoretically, were unarmed. In fact, we had a 4-inch naval gun on the stern, which could only fire backwards, so you couldn't attack anybody because you could only fire when you were running away. And but we fired it. One of the things that I often want to stress is how utterly confusing war is. I can remember a night when we were being attacked by U-boats, and it was not a clear night at all. And somebody, the information was received, there was a U-boat over there, and our gunners got busy firing at this U-boat. It turned out they were firing a brisk action against one of our own escort vessels, and we didn't know that. Then at another time, we were coming up the Bay of Biscay. The clouds were extremely low. Now, when the Germans drove us off from Dunkirk, they captured a huge number of British aircraft. British aircraft with British markings. And so they would use those, they would approach a convoy and say, oh good, British, next moment they were dropping bombs. So there was a rule that an aircraft which was a friendly aircraft approaching one of our convoys had to make a certain series of movements. And if it approached in that way, we knew it was all right. If it didn't, that was another thing. And this poor chap, the cloud was, I should think, about 750 feet. He broke out below the cloud, straight ahead of the convoy coming towards us. He hadn't time to do any manoeuvres, and he didn't do any manoeuvres because he probably hadn't even seen us. And he was shot down before he was thought. And it was an RAF plane, as it turned out. And that's the kind of confusion. I had a great friend who's dead now who commanded tanks in the desert. And he saw that was a bit like being at sea. And in the night you would see somebody who thought it was the Germans and you fired at, and it turned out to be another of your lot. Well, the last year of the war, for very complicated reasons, I finished up as a seamanship instructor at the Outer Bound Sea School at Abu Dhabi. And I don't know whether you know about that, but the Outer Bound movement people do know about. The Outer Bound Sea School was invented by the great German educationalist who fled to this country, called Kurt Hahn, and he founded Gordonston School, based on a school he'd founded in Germany. And he had the idea of these short courses for youngsters to challenge them, and the Outward Bound was the first of what has been many copies of it since. But the very first one was at Abu Dhabi. He had the ideas, and Lawrence Holt, the head of the Blue Funnel Line, was concerned about the fact that when his ships went down, lots of people got into lifeboats and didn't know what to do. So he financed this school, and every young trainee officer in the Blue Funnel Line had to spend a month at that school, and you spend it mostly in open boats. Well, why did a radio officer get to be a seamanship instructor? The story was that I was a very experienced yachtsman before the war began. Towards the end of the war, when we were building up the fleets again, the Americans were sending us ships, there was a shortage of deck officers. And apparently the ship's captain was asked to recommend somebody who, a young man who might be a deck officer. And my captain recommended me. We were coming into Gladstone Dock at the end of a voyage, and I was in the radio room, and the captain called out and said, come up to the bridge and see what happens. So I did. It was very interesting, but I didn't know why I was up there. And when I had leave and came back, I was told that the captain had recommended me to be a junior deck officer. But there was no known way of converting a radio officer into a deck officer. So they had this bright idea. They said, well, we'll send this chap down to Abu Dhabi, because all the seamanship instructors at Abu Dhabi were chief officers and second officers, navigating officers from the Blue Funnel Line. So I was sent down there to learn about boats. Well, when I'd been there 2 weeks, the boss came and called me and said, you know about boats, don't you? And I said, yes. And he arranged for me to be an instructor there for the rest of the war. At that time, it so happened I was an instructor for just a year, for the last year of the war. And I taught seamanship and tying knots, and we cruised in the Bay of Cardigan Bay in two small training ships. And there I was amongst all these navigating officers with my little yellow wiggly stripes, which weren't navigating officers at all. But it was a wonderful year, and I was just so lucky it was so, because my first baby was born whilst I was there, and I never went deep sea again. June of 1945 or something like that. And I was at Abu Dhabi. And my son asked me when he did this interview, what did you do? Well, we went to a pub up the valley somewhere, and we had drinks in a pub, and the Welshman sang beautiful songs. And that was it. There was no great hullabaloo. We just all thankful the war had come to an end.